His first significant creation, at age 16, was a reverse switch, which automatically turned off his nightlight when the headmaster opened his dorm door to check to see if he was reading after curfew. After this, the floodgates were opened, and by the end of his career, John Hayes Hammond Jr. had amassed an astounding array of over 800 patents, including inventions in the fields of military warfare, music, and sound, no relation to W.H. Hammond of electric organ fame, and home appliances. Some of Jack's most unique contributions included a cigarette case, which popped out a lit cigarette when opened, a microwave oven, a push-button radio, a super heterodyne, which greatly amplified radio waves and was coincident with Edwin Armstrong, aircraft guidance systems, a time-controlled gas bomb, a magnetic bottle cap, a combination piano-radio phonograph, a windshield washer, a mobile housing unit, and a telestereographer, or mechanism for projecting three-dimensional images via wireless. In September 1909, during his senior year, the budding Wunderkind wrote to his father to arrange for a meeting with the Serbian high priest of teleautomatics. "Father, I have some important information that I desire to get from Mr. Tesla." Hammond Sr., who had just lost his bid for the vice presidential slot, made the arrangements. Jack met the 53-year-old inventor at his Metropolitan Towers office in New York the week of September the 26th, and it is most likely that Tesla reciprocated by visiting Gloucester shortly thereafter. Hammond requested that Tesla send his patent information on wireless control of machinery, and Tesla did so before the end of the month. Moonlighting at the patent office in Washington, D.C., Jack had already rigged by this time a 40-foot vessel to be maneuvered by means of wireless. His broadcasting system, in part based on a Marconi design, also utilized Tesla's oscillators and contained two 360-foot radio control towers near the laboratory overlooking Freshwater Cove. With these devices, a man standing at a shore lookout station could steer an empty boat in the water. Jack also asked Tesla to speak at his Yale graduation. This period in Tesla's life was marked by extreme bitterness, because Marconi was rewarded for his piracy with the Nobel Prize in December. Tesla informed Jack that the Italian tinkerer had abandoned the old devices of Hertz and Lodge and substituted mine instead. In this manner, the transmission across the Atlantic was affected. Jack, however, held no ill will toward Marconi, and included him prominently in the four-volume compendium he was writing on the history of wireless communication. He also invited Marconi to the Gloucester compound and formed a friendship that would last well into the 1930s. Having returned from a European excursion where he had visited electrical engineers and psychic researchers in London, Paris, and St. Petersburg, Jack was able to complete his master's dissertation. Mr. Tesla, in 1892, showed that the true Hertzian effect was not a means by which it was possible for a sending station to communicate with a receiving station at any great distance. He demonstrated furthermore that waves propagated at a transmitting station traveled along the ground as a conductor. Today, 1912, it is acknowledged that these views are correct. It was, however, left to the splendid enterprise of Marconi to crystallize the results of previous investigators into a complete and practical system of space telegraphy. In 1897, Mr. Marconi transmitted messages to a distance of 8.7 miles. Today, Mr. Marconi says that the maximum effective distance of transmission is 6,000 miles. Perturbed with Hammond's decision to highlight Marconi's dubious achievements and proceed in his field of remote control, Tesla sought compensation. Working with Fritz Lowenstein and Alexander Graham Bell, Jack invented a mechanical dog which followed its master when a lantern was beamed at it. Created in the shape of a milk carton on wheels, the critter made use of selenium cells for eyes to receive the glimmering command signal. Hammond assured Tesla that he was not infringing upon his work in teleautomatics, but Tesla remained unconvinced, especially after an article in the newspapers reported that Hammond was in the midst of displaying remote-controlled torpedoes to the military. "My dear Mr. Hammond, judging from the enclosed, I think that you are playing a wireless possum. Notwithstanding your assurances, I will watch your progress and bring a friendly suit for infringement as soon as I ascertain that you are in funds." Jack wrote back to reconfirm that he would give proper credit, but Tesla wanted a contract and a percentage of any profits. "My dear Mr. Tesla," the 22-year-old wrote back, "I am very agreeable to share the profits with you, but I shall only on the condition that you share our liabilities also. As I naturally surmised that your papa would pay all our liabilities," Tesla replied, "I am willing to share in these." Aside from the banter, Tesla was hoping that Hammond would succeed in his interface with the military, for now he would have a market for selling his new bladeless engines. Soon a partnership was formed, Hammond Sr. footing the bill. "Go in on this with your brother Harris," Jack's father cautioned. "He's older than you and more experienced, and be careful with Mr. Tesla. He tends to spend gold as if it were copper." Having studied Tesla's method of selective tuning, Jack came to call it the 1903 Prophetic Genius Patent. Tesla had created this invention due to a recurrent problem which he'd noticed in 1894-95, namely, that he'd been having difficulty illuminating particular bulbs in his laboratory without illuminating others. After studying the work of Herbert Spencer on the combined action of two or more nerves in the human body, the inventor came upon a plan whereby bulbs would illuminate only when a combination of more than one frequency was transmitted. Jack noted that Mr. Tesla resembles his system to a combination lock. Explaining the particulars to the initiate, Tesla showed that devices could be made to respond not only to one frequency, but to two, three, or even more. This combined arrangement, analogous to today's TV and telephone scramblers, would not only ensure privacy, it would also allow for a system with a virtually unlimited number of separate channels. The corresponding patent, along with Tesla's method of utilizing resonant earth frequencies for transmission, that is, Tesla currents, became the backbone for a plethora of inventions ranging from military guidance systems to radio and telecommunications. The further development and refinement of this foundation would also eventually make Jack and a few other inventors millionaires, for example, Edwin H. Armstrong. In 1911, writing from the patent office where Jack was still employed, the willing prodigy informed Tesla that he had contacted the War Department with the hope of selling ship-to-shore communication systems capable of transmitting 20 words per minute. Jack had also begun the construction of a military-linked think tank at Gloucester, where he hired such competent engineers as Fritz Lowenstein and Benjamin Franklin Meisner. Born in 1890, Meisner, who would come to author a textbook on radio dynamics with some help from Tesla, became chief assistant at the lab. Having worked for the U.S. Navy in 1908, Meisner had aided in the development of the electric dog and the super heterodyne. He is also credited with inventing the cat whisker, which was a detector on the crystal radio set. Jack was also conferring with Reginald Fessenden, Lee De Forest, John S. Stone, and Guglielmo Marconi. Washington, D.C., February the 16th, 1911. "Dear Mr. Tesla, let us create an unpretentious company and call it the Tesla-Hammond Wireless Development Company. In thinking of this name, I have followed Emersonian advice, and as you see, have attached my chariot to a star. The purpose of this company would be to perfect an automatic selective system, to perfect the submersible torpedo, and eventually to carry out your magnificent projects that will wirelessly electrify the world. I am most sincerely yours, John Hayes Hammond, Jr. 202 Metropolitan Towers, New York City. February the 18th, 1911. "Dear Mr. Hammond, the Tesla-Hammond combination looks good to me, but we should have to go at it with some circumspection. I have already interested a gentleman who signs himself J.P.M. in a part of my wireless inventions, and my friend Astor is now waiting for the completion of my plant to go into the wireless power transmission business, which should be a colossal success. In the art of teleautomatics, however, I am perfectly free, and will be glad to go into any fair proposition to exploit the field. I think that in a few years this departure will command the attention of the world. I have just completed my turbines, and am starting Monday to install them at the Edison plant, where I expect to show them to you in operation on your next visit to the city. With kind regards, N. Tesla. Writing on his classy Wardenclyffe letterhead, with the magnifying transmitter posing at the top of the page, the inventor pens, in the estimation of this author, a most exasperating dispatch. The tiff that Tesla had had with Morgan had been held in secret. Only a handful of people even knew the details of their contract. Even Tesla's closest friends and latter-day biographers were kept in the dark. However, on another level, it had become obvious by 1911 to all but Tesla that Wardenclyffe was a ship with a lead hull. Still intoxicated with the world telegraphy idea, filled with hope that his new bladeless turbines would cause a revolution, the perennial iconoclast embarked foolhardily, albeit courageously, on the best-case scenario, that he would raise enough capital with new inventions to finally return to Long Island to complete the tower. Perhaps it is still possible at this juncture of his life, if his motor, for instance, replaced the gasoline engine in the automobile or the prop engine in the airplane. However, what was not possible was the intimation in the letter that Morgan was still interested. This was a blatant display of disinformation, which the pompous Waldorf dandy conceitedly proclaimed in order to hide the very fact, maybe even to himself, that his optimism was possibly delusion. Here was a chance to develop a concrete wireless system with the backing of the wealthy and powerful Hammond lineage. But Tesla turned the opportunity away because of arrogant, tunnel-minded, and narcissistic proclivities, and possibly because of contractual limitations imposed by the Morgan contract. Had he developed the wireless scheme with Jack, he may have had to legally compensate Morgan with 51% of any developments he achieved. Hammond hadn't figured that the star he had hitched himself to was a half-baked comet. The Apostle of Figments. In May 1911, T.C. Martin invited Tesla to address 1,300 members of the National Electric Light Association, which was holding its annual symposium at the Engineering Society building on 39th Street. "There is no enjoyment that I could picture in my mind so exquisite as the triumph which follows an original invention or discovery," the inculcation began. "But the world is not always ready to accept the dictum of the inventor, and doubters are plentiful, so that discoverers have often to swallow bitter pills along with their pleasure." But what magniloquent pills would this mad scientist force his congregation to ingest? Tesla proceeded to dazzle the audience with slides of his AC polyphase system, teleautomaton, and world wireless experiments, flashing pictures from Colorado with streamers extending 65 feet. In discussing his method of individuation, he stated that the broadcasting of combination and multiple frequencies was benefited in a system that did not use wires. "All the statements that you read in the newspapers that wireless messages are interfered with," the inventor explained, "are because the workers in that field are laboring under delusions. They are transmitting messages by Hertz waves, and in this way, no secrecy is possible." Having skyrocketed his vision to a world which was not of this earth, the wizard now stepped into the shoes of Prometheus. "Now, the discovery of standing waves that I have made upset all that has gone before, for there was a means of projecting energy into space, absolutely without loss, from any point of the globe to another, to the antipodes, if desired. In fact, a force impressed at one point could be made to increase with distance. You can imagine how profoundly I was affected by this revelation. Technically, it meant that the Earth as a whole had a certain period of vibration." Set against a sky of thunderclouds, the Wardenclyffe Citadel was flashed on the screen, its mushroom-shaped vertex looming. "I have annihilated distance in my scheme," Deus roared, "and when perfected, it will not be one mite different than my present plans call for. The air will be my medium, and I will be able to transmit energy of any amount to any place. I will be able to issue messages to all parts of the world, and send forth words which will come out of the ground in the Sahara Desert with such force that they can be heard for 15 miles around. It would be possible by my powerful wireless transmitter to light the entire United States. The current would pass into the air and, spreading in all directions, produce the effect of a strong aurora borealis. It would be a soft light, but sufficient to distinguish objects. Naturally, the tower would also be powerful enough to send signals to nearby planets, especially if there were any Martians out there to receive them. And this was just the introduction to the topic he came to divulge that night, the Tesla bladeless turbine. Tesla began to work on his new engines in earnest, shuffling between Providence and Bridgeport, with most of his operations now shifted to the New York Edison Waterside Station. He also looked for prospective clients. One of his plans was to sell, probably through Jacob Schiff, 500 engines to the Japanese. "By applying my turbine to their torpedo," Tesla wrote Jack's brother Harris, "I can double the power. We should negotiate royalties on the basis of horsepower." Tesla also conferred with GE and the exuberant Cyberling Company, leaders in the development of high-speed powerboats. Promising great success, the Vulcan worked overtime, forging his revolutionary equipment, as Jack continued perfecting a prototype remote-operated boat and a wireless broadcasting station. With a range of 2,000 miles, the Hammond transmitter became the most important private sending station in the world. Jack also studied telephotography, and he worked on perfecting his electric dog. "And if you reverse the motor by pushing over the tail switch," Jack announced to the press, "you can make the dog back away most surprisingly in either direction when you advance upon him with the light." Expanding his market, Tesla designed prototypes that could transmutate the gasoline engine in the automobile. He began to make overtures to Ford Motor Company and also Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany, who was planning on putting them in tanks. As with any new creation, there were problems. For instance, because the ball bearings were wearing down too quickly, the discs were not maintaining their spins at optimum accelerations. As a sun dodger, Tesla also had a penchant for working throughout the night, and therefore his labor costs were often double. Naturally, there were other expenditures. Jack suggested more publicity and sent over the well-known journalist, Vladimir Kempfert, to interview, in Kempfert's words, "the temperamental genius for Scientific American." But in Tesla's estimation, he had enough publicity. He needed more capital. Throughout the latter part of 1912 and through the first months of the new year, Tesla sent urgent pleas to his partner. He had expended $18,000, had worked without salary for all this time, and required $10,000 back immediately. "Dear Mr. Hammond, in desperate need of money, I am unable to hold out any longer." But Hammond, who was helping Lowenstein install his wireless equipment aboard Navy ships and competing against DeForest for a $50,000 amplifier deal with AT&T, ignored the request, his brother Harris taking a full quarter of a year to respond. June 10, 1913. "Dear Mr. Tesla, as you know, we have advanced a great many thousands of dollars in the development of this turbine, and have expected each week the past year to be in a position to have tested it. Now we find that the turbine is only partially set up at the Edison plant. We are missing a splendid opportunity of having it thoroughly and honestly tested by people who would be the greatest benefit to us should these tests be successful. Sincerely yours, Harris Hammond." The high priest of teleautomatics was incapable of believing that the son of one of the richest men in the world was scorning his entreaty. "Since my notice, I have done the best I could to save what was possible. The sacrifices which I have been compelled to make and the losses which I have suffered are such that if I were dealing with a man less attractive to me than yourself, I would disdain to answer." Tesla also enclosed glowing testaments to the turbine from professors and chief engineers, but the partnership was over. Hammond would not come through. The castle that Jack built. Jack Hammond traveled to Europe only months before World War I to confer with various scientists in order to perfect a better receiving instrument than the Marconi coherer. It appears that Tesla and Hammond were working at cross purposes. As would become obvious, the $10,000 Tesla requested would not have been sufficient to complete his work on the turbines. He probably needed 40 or 50 times that figure, and Jack's main interest lay in the perfection of wireless transmitting and receiving apparatus. The torpedo propellants were really secondary. In retrospect, it seems that Tesla might have been better off abandoning the turbine for the time being and working with Jack to perfect the guidance system. But he was too close to a potential major success to sink more time into an invention he had already perfected 15 years earlier. Jack would go on in 1913 and 1914 to demonstrate his remote-controlled boat before the U.S. military elite. General Weaver, chief of the U.S. Coast Artillery, and a small entourage traveled up to Gloucester to witness the Natalia, the prodigal son's newest success, the general even taking the controls himself. Again and again the flashing craft shot forth and maneuvered about the harbour under invisible control, while natives of Gloucester gasped in amazement. They saw her headed for a definite mark a mile away, 2 miles, 3 miles away, and strike it with precision every time. A few weeks later, Hammond Jr. demonstrated the long-range capabilities of the vessel. It could operate while 20 miles away from the Gloucester radio transmitter, and in one way or another was directed the full distance of 60 miles to the naval base at Newport by means of wireless. Jack had also perfected the problem of static interference and selective tuning. In December, he wrote, "My dear father, we are now drawing up as systematically as possible the whole proposition to present to the Board of Ordnance. This work means a good deal in the future financial success of the proposition. I am your affectionate son, John Hayes Hammond, Jr." It would be many years, however, before the U.S. government recompensed Jack for his remote-controlled guidance system. He would expend over the next decade in the neighborhood of $750,000 on the operation, expanding the system of radiodynamic control to include aircraft as well as submersibles. Problems in the creation of secret channels were made apparent in 1915 and 1916 when the USS Dolphin successfully interfered with a torpedo launched by Hammond over distances of 200 to 300 feet, but the Hammond system was successful when the torpedo was launched farther away. The War Department also wanted to sustain visual contact of the weapon, so Jack began working on a device to be directed from flying machines. Every problem he encountered, he was able to overcome. The technology was still too new to be used during World War I, and the military kept avoiding expenditure of any funds. Ostensibly waiting for Tesla's fundamental teleautomatic patents to expire, Jack finally presented his case before members of Congress. He stated that he had overtures from foreign governments, but he would refuse to negotiate with them because of the importance of the work and loyalty to his country. And so, in 1919, while his father, John Hayes Hammond Sr., continued to gain publicity for his idea of a world court to prevent war, the U.S. Congress and President Wilson approved an appropriation of $417,000 for the war patents for Hammond's son. However, still no monies changed hands. In the 1920s, Jack began working with David Sarnoff, who, along with Guglielmo Marconi and Edwin Armstrong, was forming the seeds of the Radio Corporation of America, RCA. And in 1923, the fruits of his labor paid off when Jack sold a series of wireless patents to RCA for $500,000, but he was still to be compensated by the U.S. government. In 1924, Hammond sent yet another dispatch to the War Department to gain the release of the appropriated funds, which were now up to $750,000. "I have brought the development to a state where we have demonstrated the feasibility of control of standard naval torpedoes while running at depths of 6 feet or over, submerged at speeds of 27 to 30 knots per hour," Hammond wrote. Finally, in December 1924, with the help of Curtis Wilbur, Secretary of the Navy and admirer of Hammond's father, the government made good, recompensing Hammond and assigning his work to a secret file in the Patent Office. Assurances were also given that their exclusive patents did not compete with those sold to RCA. All this took place a full decade after his breakup with his Serbian mentor, who now had the pleasure of simply looking on when others are using my inventions. "I wish him luck," Tesla said, "but still I ought to have had something for it." Tesla also pointed out that Hammond sought his patents just a few months after Tesla's had run out. Now a millionaire on his own merits, Jack set out to fulfill a dream that began in his youth when the family moved to England, namely, to live in a castle. He also fell in love with an artist, Irene Fenton, a lovely daughter of a shipbuilder who unfortunately was married to a shoe merchant. Irene, 45, got divorced and married Jack, 37, clandestinely in 1925, as he began construction of the medieval dwelling which was situated on the cloistered and treacherous coastal cliffs where Longfellow wrecked the fictitious schooner Hesperus in Gloucester. The site was less than a mile from his parents' home. Jack's passion was music. Although not a musician, he had many acoustical patents, and also an organ that was so enormous, comprising 8,000 pipes, that a palace would be the only edifice capable of housing it. Hammond designed the all-stone building around the instrument, complete with parapets, a moat, and a chain-link drawbridge. Inside could be found dark, winding corridors, hidden doorways, and breakaway walls at the entrance of the great room for moving organ pipes into it and out. In the center of the castle, which today is a museum, Hammond placed an indoor swimming pool and an atrium filled with plants and tropical birds. Ancient artifacts from Europe were purchased, and a nude statue of the celebrated innovator was sculpted, Irene designing a metal fig leaf to subdue the piece. Jack continued to work on a long series of top-secret inventions for the War Department and for himself, as he lived the life of the bon vivant. Visitors to his estate and to his pipe organ concerts in the 1930s included the Hursts, George Gershwin, Helen Hayes, David Sarnoff, Anne and Theodore Edison, the Marconis, J. Pierpont Morgan's daughter Louisa and her husband Herbert Satterley, Helen Astor, Maria Carnegie, David Rockefeller, the Barrymores, Noel Coward, and Leopold Stokowski. It is doubtful that Tesla ever visited the castle, although he might have, but on March 30, 1951, nearly a decade after the Serb's death, another Slav and Teslarian, Andrea Puharic, stopped by. Still interested in extrasensory perception, Jack had invited Puharic, a medical doctor and inventor of hearing aids, along with psychic Eileen Garrett, to his citadel for the purpose of testing her telepathic abilities. Placed in a Faraday cage so that electromagnetic waves could be screened out, Garrett performed at a level that astounded the experimenters. A world traveler and prodigious innovator throughout his life, Jack spent much of his time in the latter years traveling with his wife across the country in a mobile home he had designed. One day, on a trip to see his friend Igor Sikorsky in Bridgeport, the inventor of the helicopter asked if Jack wanted one as a present. "Only if it can take my mobile home," Jack responded. After a long pause, with time out to stare at the mobile monstrosity, Igor responded, "It can be done." John Hayes Hammond, Jr. died in 1965 at the age of 77. A genius in his own right, it is unfortunate that his relationship with Tesla was thwarted. Together, they invented a rather sizable chunk of the appliances of the modern era. 39. J.P. Morgan, Jr., 1912 to 1914. April 18, 1912. My dear Mr. Tesla, I attended the Marconi meeting last night in company with illustrious society. The everlasting toastmaster, T.C. Martin, read in most theatrical fashion a telegram, and after a pause of fully 3 minutes, announced its author as Thomas A. Edison. Mr. Marconi gave the history, as he sees it, of wireless up to this date. He does not speak any more of Hertzian wave telegraphy, but accentuates that messages he sends out are conducted along the earth. Pupin had the floor next, showing that wireless was due entirely to one single person. The only speaker of the evening who understood Mr. Marconi's merit, who did not hesitate to vent his opinion, was Steinmetz. In a brief historical sketch, he maintained that while all elements necessary for the transmission of wireless energy were available, it was due to Marconi that intelligence was actually transmitted. That evening was, without any question, the highest tribute that I have ever heard paid to you in the language of absolute silence as to your name. Sincerely yours, Fritz Lowenstein. Tesla was in the midst of working for W.M. Maxwell, superintendent of New York's public schools, on a controversial project to electrify classrooms with high-frequency currents. Following in the footsteps of a highly publicized experiment in